Light.
Camera.
Philosophy.
It's the 2024 Dionysus Awards.
For the most thought-provoking movies of the past year.
And the nominees are...
For the most disturbing exploration of a female criminal who thinks she may be innocent...
George is very sensitive. He always was very, very sensitive.
What's your relationship like with him and your other kids?
How is that relevant?
For best film about social justice that wonders what makes a good film about social justice.
Jeez, you would think a construction site at lunchtime would be the perfect place for a little woman power, but this one was so... male.
For the most moving film...
or TV show...
about difficult choices...
Let me take her.
Tess, we don't have time for this.
Oh, you don't have time?
Who is she?
To you, she's cargo.
We don't smuggle people. Sorry.
I can do it.
Join us as we celebrate the most philosophically compelling movies of the past year.
The 2024 Dionysus Awards.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Can a musical about a doll be feminist?
What kinds of crime can never be forgiven?
Is destiny a real thing?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Jeremy Sable, sitting in for Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative, and Jeremy teaches in the Structured Liberal Education Program.
I'm joining Josh once again for our annual celebration of some of our favorite, most philosophically compelling movies of the past year. It's the Dionysus Awards.
Jeremy, 2023 was kind of a mixed year for film, but there was some really great stuff in there, like Killers of the Flower Moon, Zone of Interest, Poor Things.
I loved all of those. But today we'll be giving awards to some other movies, including a pair of films vying for Most Disturbing Exploration of a Female Criminal Who Thinks She May Be Innocent.
We'll also consider nominees in the category of Most Moving Film
or TV Show
about Difficult Choices.
And in the category Best Film About Social Justice that wonders what makes a good film about social justice, we'll be thinking about American Fiction and Barbie.
We'll also take nominations from listeners like you, who've written to us about other thought-provoking, Dionysus-worthy films.
Now, back in the summer, there was this fun pretend rivalry between Barbie and Oppenheimer, another excellent movie.
So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out more about our so-called Summer of Barbenheimer. She files this report.
He's a physicist with a naughty twist, Oppenheimer.
If you had to sum up popular culture in 2023 with one word, Barbenheimer might be it.
The sky is on it. His bombs are atomic.
We are doing bombs, brunch, and Barbie next week. So we're doing a double feature with Oppenheimer and Barbie.
Moviegoers flock to see Barbie, a film about the doll, and Oppenheimer, a film about the creator of the atomic bomb on the same day.
You know when you watch a scary movie, you needed like an upper afterwards to like make you feel less terrified? It's kind of what we're going to do.
The first one has got to be Oppenheimer, just because I could get the depressing stuff out of the way first. Oh, that was a downer. Okay, let's go have fun at Barbie.
It was this representation of dark and light, masculine, feminine, the movie snob versus the casual moviegoer.
Steve Grinnelli is a professor at Northeastern University, where he studies popular culture and messaging.
It was a coming together of disparate audiences, all together on the same day.
The release day for both films became like an event in an era with few timed events. The Super Bowl is a rare example.
Mahomes flings it. It's there! Hartman! Jackpot! Kansas City!
Fans couldn't wait for either film to come out on Netflix to be part of the phenomenon. The other reason Barbie resonated with people is because so many were curious about how such a popular doll with so much history and baggage would be portrayed.
Oh, is this going to be a subversion of a traditional Barbie narrative?
Moviegoers showed up to Barbie Mania dressed in pink.
I feel so beautiful.
So do I.
This is the best day ever.
It is the best day ever, and so is yesterday, and so is tomorrow, and so is the day after tomorrow, and even Wednesdays, and every day from now until forever.
Do you guys ever think about dying?
Is this going to address, like, you know, the impact that it's had on the presentation of feminism? Like, how is this going to be done? Do we trust Greta Gerwig enough that we're just going to walk into a theater and say, show me what happened?
I feel that I have blood on my hands.
And when it comes to Oppenheimer, people also were already familiar with the storyline, how bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan and led to the deaths of 200,000 people in an effort to end World War II. Audiences just needed to meet Robert Oppenheimer, considered the father of the atomic bomb.
Dr. Oppenheimer, it's an honor.
Mr. President.
Please.
Thank you.
Steve Grinnelli says a cultural movie event like Barbenheimer would be difficult to manufacture again. Movie producers could plan for two very different films premiering on the same day and see if people come out to see both. But no one wants to feel like they're part of a marketing ploy.
When audiences perceive the manipulation, when they're like, they think we're going to go see this, so they're putting out this on this date. Like anybody who's kind of, if you're knowledgeable about that, then I can see that people may perceive that as condescending.
I'm not seeing Barbie.
You're not going to pay to see Barbie. Why not?
Doesn't look good.
You never had the Barbie Dreamhouse?
Nah, dog.
Barbie and Oppenheimer became a temporary boon for theaters across the country that are still struggling post-pandemic. And if the unlikely combo of plastic dolls and atomic bombs can help cinema survive...
You understand that humans only have one ending. Ideas live forever. Humans not so much.
Maybe that's what it takes. But keep in mind, movie executives, we want the power to control the next cultural phenomenon.
I want to do the imagining. I don't want to be the idea.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that blockbuster report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my guest co-host, Jeremy Sable. And today it's our annual Dionysus Awards for the most philosophically compelling movies of the past year.
But let's get right to our first award. We've got two contenders in the category Best Film About Social Justice that wonders what makes a good film about social justice, American Fiction and Barbie.
You know, Jeremy, I absolutely loved Barbie. I loved it. It's not just a powerful exploration of gender relations. It's also a hoot. Those extravagant sets, the fabulous performances, the hilarious musical numbers. There's even a reference to a Proust Barbie.
Yeah, that's the one that didn't sell, right? Was it the plastic Madeleines?
I don't know. But I love it so much. And there's a brilliant joke involving a politically aware teenager calling Barbie a fascist.
She thinks I'm a fascist? I don't control the railways or the flow of commerce?
I thought that was great, too. But I'm not sure about your claim that this movie is a powerful exploration of gender relations.
What do you mean? You've got a vision of a world ruled by women. You've got a nefarious Ken who wants to introduce the patriarchy into Barbie land. You got a barnstorming speech by America Ferrera illustrating the contradictions of gendered expectations.
You're supposed to stay pretty for men, but not so pretty that you tempt them too much or that you threaten other women because you're supposed to be a part of the sisterhood, but always stand out and always be grateful.
Well, sure, Josh. But what's the name of the movie again?
Barbie?
Right. Last time I checked, Barbie was a product sold by Mattel. This movie was the brainchild of Mattel. I mean, it's a feature-length advertisement, just like Steve Grinnelli was saying earlier. And what is Mattel up to? Convincing girls that they need to grow up into impossibly tall and skinny women. And by the way, Margot Robbie isn't going to disabuse them of that.
But the movie's way ahead of you, Jeremy. Look, first of all, there are zillions of Barbies in this movie. Different body types, different races, different professions. There's even a transgender Barbie. Plus, it makes a joke about Margot Robbie being the star.
What? You're so pretty.
I'm not stereotypical Barbie pretty.
Note to the filmmakers, Margot Robbie is the wrong person to cast if you want to make this point.
This movie totally knows what it's doing.
Okay, but so what? I mean, self-awareness can't save something sucky from being sucky. This movie presents itself as a feminist manifesto, and it totally fails.
What do you mean?
Well, okay, this is a bit of a spoiler, but think about what happens halfway through. Barbie Land gets taken over by the patriarchy, and guess what? The Barbies love it. Patriarchy is fun. That's not feminism.
Anyone need a brewski beer?
What are you doing? You're a doctor.
I like being a helpful decoration.
And Alan likes to help me give all the Kens foot massages.
No, I don't. I don't like that.
We love it.
I see that bit totally differently, Jeremy. Look, for me, that's a brilliant exploration of what some philosophers have called false consciousness. You know, when you think you want something, but that desire has really been foisted on you by your culture.
You're probably thinking of one of my favorite philosophers, Simone de Beauvoir. She says the patriarchy can make itself seem very attractive. Women can cite all kinds of reasons for buying into it. That's what makes it so dangerous.
Exactly.
Okay, but even if you're right that the middle part of Barbie is about false consciousness, and that's a big if, there's still the small matter of the ending.
All right, what about it?
Okay, plot spoiler, the Barbies fight back. And what are their weapons? Their so-called feminine wiles?
Or distract them with the old standby, wearing glasses so that they can discover that you're pretty.
Yeah.
Sure, go ahead.
All this does is reinforce bad gender stereotypes. And it's hardly a recipe for revolution. You're not going to change the world by smiling cutely.
Might I remind you, Jeremy, that we're talking about a movie?
Sure, but you're the one that said it was feminist.
Well, it's a feminist movie, but it's not a feminist manifesto. Look, it could have done all the things you seem to be asking for, but then it wouldn't have got all those viewers in the door. It's broken all kinds of records. Don't you want people to see movies that make them think about gender?
Well, sure, but I also wish broccoli tasted more like M&M's. The thing is, if it did, it would be M&M's. The very fact that Barbie appealed to so many people is kind of a bad sign.
I don't agree. Barbie isn't an art movie that failed. It's a bit of fluffy, big-budget mass entertainment that miraculously went beyond its remit.
That does remind me of one thing, that fantastic note of sarcasm early in the film, where the narrator says,
"Thanks to Barbie, all problems of feminism and equal rights have been solved."
She isn't just making fun of Barbie dolls. She's also warning critics not to expect too much of this one movie, as though a piece of mass entertainment is going to fix the world's problems.
After all, they're living in Barbie land. Who am I to burst their bubble?
Thinking about burdening art with the problems of the world, let's talk about American fiction.
Sure. American fiction is all about the expectations that society places on African-American writers. The protagonist, Monk, just wants to tell timeless, universal stories. But that's not what the world wants.
Right. In this movie, white readers desperately want black fictions to be testimony. In fact, they want it all to tell a single story, a story of suffering, poverty, and desperate choices.
I think now will come some sort of, you know, dumb, melodramatic sob story where you highlight your broken interiority. Mm-hmm. Something like, I don't know.
I hates this man. I hates my mama, and I hates myself.
You can see why a well-intentioned white reader might want that. Lots of great art shares diverse perspectives on life and helps us to understand why things are the way they are. And when it comes to race relations in today's America, there's an awful lot that needs explaining.
But still, demanding that all African-American novels be a form of sociology and represent only one kind of life, in the movie, this is a way of relegating them to second-class status.
Wait a minute. Why are these books here?
I'm not sure. I would imagine that this author, Ellison, is black.
That's me, Ellison.
Yeah.
He is me, and he and I are black.
Oh, bingo.
No bingo, Ned. These books have nothing to do with African-American studies. They're just literature. The blackest thing about this one is the ink.
These novels never get to lay claim to universality or to the many functions of fiction available to white authors. They only ever get to do one thing.
I remember Toni Morrison raising a similar concern in one of her prefaces. She said white readers trap African-American writers in a box, judging every work by political criteria. Quote, "If the novel was good, it was because it was faithful to a certain kind of politics. If it was bad, it was because it was faithless to them. The judgment was based on whether black people are or are not like this."
Right. American fiction is raising the same questions about what readers should want, what society should venerate, what we should be expecting from our artists.
Plus, this movie is hilarious, and it's beautifully subtle. The protagonist, Monk, has some real serious flaws. I wouldn't want to date him. And the movie raises questions, but it doesn't answer them for us.
I don't want him to make some grandiose speech spoon-feeding everyone the moral of the story. There is no moral. That's the idea. I like the ambiguity.
And the other great thing about American fiction is its subplot. I don't know, give too much away here, but the subplot's all about Monk's everyday life. A parent with dementia, a sibling with health problems, another sibling who's living the high life, the fear of becoming your father. This is exactly the kind of story that Monk wants to tell.
You gave her opioids to sleep?
Yeah. You ever seen a heroin addict? Those guys take naps standing up.
It's dangerous.
Look, I'm keeping an eye on her. I'm a doctor.
So am I.
Right. Maybe if we need to revive a sentence.
This movie is about a guy who can't get to tell his timeless stories about universal human issues. But the movie itself does exactly that. In the movie, African-American writers can't achieve success that way. But in real life, this film, written by African-American writers, is up for multiple awards, and deservedly so.
So thinking of awards, Jeremy, we've got Barbie and we've got American Fiction. Which should win the Dionysus?
I loved both of them, but there's no question in my mind. American Fiction isn't just better than Barbie. I think it was the film of the year.
So, the 2024 Dionysus Award for Best Film About Social Justice That Wonders What Makes a Good Film About Social Justice goes to...
American Fiction.
I'd be standing outside in the night.
Deadbeat dads, rappers, crack.
You said you wanted black stuff.
That's black, right?
I see what you're doing.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our annual Dionysus Awards, honoring the most thought-provoking movies of the past year.
Coming up, we'll consider nominees in the categories of most disturbing exploration of a female criminal who thinks she may be innocent, and most moving film
or TV show
about difficult choices.
Movies about kismet, crime, and confusion, along with nominations from you, our listeners, when Philosophy Talk continues.
It's the annual Dionysus Awards. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Jeremy Sable, sitting in for Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about movies from the past year that challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways.
Two films that made me think about things in new ways were May December and Saint-Omer. Saint-Omer is a French-language film directed by Alice Diop, and it's about a woman on trial for murdering her infant, and also about a woman who comes to witness the trial.
And May December is about a woman who slept with an underage coworker at a pet store, and also about the actress who's going to play her in a movie.
To find out which of those two offers the most disturbing exploration of a female criminal who thinks she may be innocent, we spoke to Francie Russell, professor of philosophy at Columbia University, who works on cinematic aesthetics and writes film criticism. We asked her why these two films make such a good pair.
They both take as their subject a news story from the real world, a kind of true crime story about a sensational crime committed by a woman. So they have both kind of Greek tragic proportions, and yet they're based in reality. Both films engage in a really interesting visual and narrative engagement with two women and the sort of uneasy relationships between them. And I think the question of knowledge of another and self-knowledge are themes that run throughout both of these films.
Okay, Saint-Omer, I found brilliant and deeply troubling. Based on a true story of a woman who killed her own child. And in the film, at least, she's presented as not understanding why she did it. Is that part of what you're talking about when you say these are films that explore self-knowledge? This seems like a case of radical failure of self-knowledge. I don't know why I did this truly heinous thing.
No, it's truly unsettling. The characters, her name is Laurence. Her first words in the movie, the judge asks, "Do you know why you killed your child?" And she says, "I don't know. I hope this trial will help me figure it out."
Madame Colly, savez-vous pourquoi vous avez tué votre fille?
Je ne le sais pas. J'espère que ce procès pourra me l'apprendre.
Est-ce que vous reconnaissez les faits?
Oui, je les reconnais.
Qu'est-ce que vous plaidez?
Je plaide non coupable, Madame la Présidente. Je ne suis pas sûre d'être la vraie responsable dans cette affaire.
The character fully admits that she committed the crime. That's not in question. And so then there's an interesting question about, well, what are we doing here? What's the mystery? What's the legal procedure after? And what are we as audience members after? And by saying, I don't know, right at the beginning, the question of figuring this woman out and whether she will be figurable, I think, becomes a sort of central site of dramatic tension.
And it makes a difference in terms of the outcome of the court case, right? Because one thing is established, she's confessed to the murder. But the question is, how should we understand the murder? The prosecution says she's a monster, she needs to be stopped. And the defense says, well, she's sick and she needs help. And an expert witness says, well, she deserves her empathy. Maybe there's a kind of justification, which is sort of odd. So there are stakes here, right? Usually in a courtroom drama, it's did the person do it or who did it? This is not a whodunit, this is a whydunit.
I see a few different discourses of explanation operating in the film. So there's the question of insanity, which would mean she was not culpable and that she would be, I think the defense attorney wants to say she deserves some kind of psychiatric treatment rather than a sentence. There's the prosecuting attorney who says she's not mad, she's fully capable, she's vengeful, she's angry, and she killed her daughter and so should be tried accordingly. And then the last discourse that comes into play is witchcraft. Because she is from Senegal, and even though she identifies with a sort of Western philosophical tradition, she calls herself a Cartesian thinker at one point. She studied Wittgenstein in college, but she says witchcraft is the only explanation, nothing else makes sense. And then later her mother gets on the witness stand to talk about this.
Tout ça est orchestré. J'entends vos sourires, mais moi, ça ne me fait pas rire. Il y a de la sorcellerie, je vous assure. Une malédiction même.
I want to go back to something you said at the very outset, which is that both of these films involve an intermediary. So, you know, on the one hand, we're focused on this woman who's done this heinous crime, and we're in a courtroom, and we're worried about what she's done, and how can she explain it? But we also have this witness who is so much part of the center stage of the film, and also who often in disturbing ways stands for us as viewers, that we somehow are kind of in her place. What do you make of that? Like, what's Saint-Omer doing there with this intermediary character who is kind of, as you say, in a Greek tragic way, it's almost like a chorus that we have to join in on?
I think the character of Rama in Saint-Omer is crucial. Anthony Lane wrote in his New Yorker article that she was unnecessary for the film, and I just thought it completely misread what the film is doing.
Yeah.
Because it seems to be so much a relay of identifications and transferences. So Rama comes to report on the trial for a book that she's going to call Medea Castaway. So we also learn that Rama is pregnant, and the film suggests she's ambivalent about it. And so this question of our access to Laurence, this opaque figure, is always mediated through Rama and her anxieties about what this woman's capacities for violence and for incomprehension, how is she implicated in that? And how does, what kind of academic distance is she going to be able to retain in order to write this story, if any?
Yeah,
I think that's a great point. And something I found kind of brilliantly troubling is the sort of set of ways in which Rama seems to be thinking about this court case. Because as you said, she is thinking of making a film about it, which she wants to call Médée Naufragée, Castaway Medea. You know, because Medea, I mean, she's a complicated figure, but she's not a villain quite in the Greek tradition, right? She's given justifications for the act that she's committed. And the castaway part makes it sound like, well, really the way to think about her is a victim. She's a kind of a victim of a system. And we hear about some pretty significant racism towards her. And her boyfriend, you know, was not a great guy who took advantage of her and so on. And there's also the very beginning of the film where we see Rama teaching a class,
yeah,
and talking about a scene from Hiroshima Mon Amour, the film by Marguerite Duras, and saying, look at Duras sublimating suffering into something lyrical.
Cette femme, objet d'opprobre, devient grâce aux mots de l'écrivain, non seulement une héroïne, mais un sujet en état de grâce.
It seems like we're supposed to think of what we see later in the film in the light of that. Either this infanticide is being sort of aestheticized, turning awfulness into something lyrical, which is troubling, or it's being kind of exonerated. Well, you know, she's kind of a victim of circumstance, so of course she killed her own child.
There's a way in which the opacity of the Laurence character, one of the things the film does so well, is shows how that can be intensely attractive to us and a site of fantasies. So someone who commits a taboo and refuses to give an account of themselves is a very compelling figure for us. They have sort of walked the boundary of what we accept as human and refuse to make sense of themselves in the terms we find acceptable. And so in a way, I think the only discourse that can be adequate to that would be something aesthetic.
Yeah.
Because morality and legality and agency and psychiatry suddenly feel to fall incredibly short of what we've seen.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our annual Dionysus Awards show, and we're thinking about the most disturbing exploration of a female criminal who thinks she may be innocent, with Francie Russell from Columbia University.
This is a really great transition to thinking about May December, in which we have another female protagonist who has committed a taboo criminal act, having sex with a minor, although not as opaque as in Saint-Omer, but who seems more comfortable than maybe the audience is meant to be with the choices that she's made.
My son Georgie was in the same year as Joe at school, so technically I would have met him there, but I don't have any memory of that.
Right.
Everyone's pretty close-knit here on the island, and you kind of recognize everyone. I know there was a point when he was friendlier with Georgie, but I didn't really meet him until he came to the pet store looking for a job.
It was summer after sixth grade?
Seventh.
A refrain throughout this film, May December, is people saying they don't remember how Gracie and Joe met, which is just such an improbable idea. You know, it was a national scandal in the context of the film and in the story that it was based on in real life. But the line that strikes me the most is one of the many scenes where Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman are looking in the mirror together, which is a visual motif that runs throughout the film. And they're talking about Julianne Moore's, Gracie's hopes for the evening.
What were your expectations? That tonight would go well, that my children would love me, and my life would be perfect.
And the Natalie Portman character says, well, that's a bit naive. And she looks almost directly into the camera and says,
I am naive. I always have been. In a way, it's been a gift.
And what I like about that is it's different than saying, I don't know what I did, why I did what I did. To say I'm naive, to avow it, requires being a step outside of naivete. And so when she describes herself as naive, that puts her in a very interesting, uncertain, and a little bit of an unsettling position where you don't know if she really is naive or if she has a very effective sort of defensive strategy, keeping certain questions at bay and keeping certain thoughts away. And that makes her mysterious and, again, powerful and compelling and possibly even more frightening than I find the Laurence character.
Yeah, potentially more disturbing because it might be masking a kind of complexity or depth. That complexity in Gracie is also strikingly mirrored. As you mentioned, there's this kind of sequence of scenes. It kind of runs as a leitmotif in the film of this similarity mirroring between Gracie and Elizabeth, the actress, who is not a courtroom witness, but an actor who wants to reprise and take on the character of Gracie. What do you make of what Elizabeth is doing in this film? What's her role as intermediary?
Well, I find she has a vampiric quality that comes out increasingly over the course of the film. And she has a unsettling desire for intimacies with her subject. She says things like, I want it to feel truthful. I want it to feel real.
There are things that exist inside people that don't necessarily come to head until later. And I try and look for the seeds of those things.
As you say, Elizabeth kind of goes off the deep end. She wants to plunge deep into the character of Gracie, and the result is she starts talking about young actors in really horrifying terms, and a director has to say to her, you need to come home. And it made me wonder again about Saint-Omer, where you have, on the one hand, we always think empathy is good. More empathy equals better. But in May, December, it sure seems like Elizabeth is sort of empathizing too much. She's almost letting herself be taken over by somebody who is guilty of a really bad crime. And she seems to be about to become a criminal herself, or potentially. And similarly, in Saint-Omer, we might think, you know, let's maximally empathize with everybody. Well, does that mean empathizing with someone who murdered her own child and maybe, you know, glamorizing her as a new Medea and justifying things in various kinds of ways? What do you think? Do you see these two films, Saint-Omer and May December, as raising these questions in the same kind of way? Questions about our vampirism as audiences, and questions about the dangers of empathy if it's misplaced or goes too far?
I think they raise them differently. So I don't see Elizabeth, Natalie Portman's character, as empathetic. No. I see her as appetizer. She is coming to consume the people around her. And this film doesn't suggest to me that she comes under honest pretenses and then gets sucked into this other world with this other person's psyche takes over. To me, it's much more that she comes in with fantasies of her own. She evidences her own interest in transgression. There's that incredibly creepy scene where she visits Gracie's daughter's acting class and goes into depth about what it's like to perform a sex scene.
You're wearing practically nothing, and you're rubbing up against each other and sweating for hours. And you start losing the line of like, am I pretending that I'm experiencing pleasure, or am I pretending that I'm not experiencing pleasure?
And all the kids in the scene are very aware that this is a completely inappropriate way to be speaking. And so that is the scene for me that exemplifies Elizabeth. And so again, it's not a scene where empathy is either too much or too little. And then when it comes to Saint-Omer, I don't think it's a problem of too much empathy. And I just don't have the same worry about glamorizing a murderer. I think the film does so much to suggest other sites of contact between these two women. They both have Senegalese parents. They both now live in France, have an uncertain relationship between these two cultures. They both identify with the sort of Western philosophical cultural tradition. Rama is herself feeling uncertain about what it would mean to be both a mother and an intellectual, uncertain about, you know, how can she love her own mother given their very complicated relationship? And so, of course, Laurence did commit a horrific crime, but I see all of these sort of peripheral similarities being really where Rama feels the pull. And then I think there's that moment where she suddenly sort of snaps out of it. And it's the moment when Laurence looks her in the eye and smiles. And there, I think she really is thinking, oh, I have been projecting a relationship here with someone who I've been naive about, let's say. Or there's a sort of snapping to alertness in that moment that I find very striking.
Well, Jeremy, I think Francie's made some brilliant points, especially this point about a refusal of empathy in Saint-Omer, because if I can be thoroughly convinced that Saint-Omer is not inviting us, that the project of Saint-Omer is not to invite us to give over our full empathy to the central character, wow, that really cements my admiration for that movie.
My vote's with you, Josh.
So, the 2024 Dionysus Award for most disturbing exploration of a female criminal who thinks she may be innocent goes to
Saint-Omer.
Francie, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It has been my total pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Francie Russell from Columbia University. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and we're celebrating the most philosophically compelling movies of 2023 for our annual Dionysus Awards.
In our next segment, we'll talk to my regular co-host, Ray Briggs, about nominees for Most Moving Film
or TV Show
about difficult choices.
More Dionysus winners when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back. It's Philosophy Talk's annual Dionysus Awards show. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Jeremy Sable, sitting in for Ray Briggs. We're talking about the most thought-provoking movies of the past year.
Next up, two nominees for Most Moving Film
or TV Show
about difficult choices, Past Lives and The Last of Us.
The Last of Us is a TV show based on a video game, but it miraculously made for some of the best viewing of the year. It imagines a world in which fungal infection has turned humans into zombies.
And Past Lives is about two childhood friends from South Korea who reconnect as young adults in the early days of social media and again in the present day.
We ask co-host Ray about the difficult choices and philosophical conundrums depicted in these two works of fiction.
And spoiler alert, for these two, there's going to be no way to talk about them without giving away at least some major parts of the plot.
The cool thing about Past Lives is that the main character, Nora or Nyayang, is kind of two different people in her two different cultural settings and with the two different, like, other kind of biggest characters in the story, one of whom, Arthur, is her American husband and who has a bunch of, like, American writer cultural shared reference points. And the other one, Hae-sung, who is her old sweetheart from Korea, who has a bunch of Korean reference points that she shares. And there's kind of no overlap between them, but each of them has some kind of really meaningful connection with her. And I think one of the tragedies of the movie is that she can't be both people at once. Those two people are incompatible, but she sort of has both of them as parts of her.
He was just this kid in my head for such a long time. And then he was just this image on my laptop. And now he is a physical person. It's really intense, but I don't think that that's attraction. I think I just missed him a lot. I think I miss Seoul.
So one might be tempted to say that she has become, you know, person number one was her in her youth and person number two is her adult life. But the fact that they come together in the second part of the movie, do you think that split is still happening? Is this a temporal disjunct, or is it happening kind of culturally in the movie at the same time?
Yeah, I think those two people are both there at the same time. And when she's interacting with, like, her husband and her old sweetheart, you can see both of them kind of overlapping as she's negotiating between them.
Oh, 군대.
Yes.
Oh, military service.
Hey.
You know how Korean men have mandatory military service?
Yeah, your dad talks about it. How was it? Oh. You like it?
어땠어? 좋았어?
No.
So it raises an interesting question about where a person can go from there, right? It seems a somewhat uncomfortable position to be in for Nyayang, to feel like there are two very different selves that she is. And I assume that one person might say, for example, well, look for the commonality, right? There's going to be a kind of Venn diagram intersection between these two people, these two selves. And that's who you really are, and hang on to that. And somebody else might say, well, synthesize the two, put them together, and now you've got a kind of totality that embraces these two. But sounds like you're suggesting, Ray, neither of those is an option.
I think the intersection of them is too small and boring of a person. And I think she hasn't synthesized them by the end of the movie, and, like, whether it's possible. But I think she's kind of the union of those two. I think a lot of us are the unions of separate parts that don't really fit that well together. There's this great shot of young Nyayang and Hae-sung walking their separate roads. And it gets repeated at the end of the movie. And I think that this is, like, really clear depiction of her making a choice that brings her toward oneself and not toward the other.
So, as you say, Ray, this is a film about tragedy and tragic choices. That makes me think about fate.
Right. The concept of fate is a Korean concept of inyeon, which she mentions inyeon being about having some important connection between two people's lives. But it's not necessarily a romantic connection.
It's an inyeon. If two strangers even walk by each other in the street, and their clothes accidentally brush, because it means there must have been something between them in their past lives.
In fact, Hae-sung says to Arthur, oh, maybe we have inyeon too. And that's clearly not a romantic thing. It's just some kind of connection.
That's just something Koreans say to seduce someone.
You know, when you think about Nora and all the thoughts that she has about inyeon in relation to her life shape and the choices that she's made, does it seem like it's sort of buoying her up, comforting her, consoling her? Do you think it's maybe doing the opposite? Could there be a kind of worry? I'm not sort of living the life that my past lives have laid out for me? Or is it kind of neutral?
Yeah, I think that there's a concern that it's bad for her, because if you have this idea about how your life is supposed to go, and then you compare it to the reality isn't going to measure up. And she sort of has this collection of ideals, and the reality doesn't quite measure up to any of them.
Childhood sweethearts who reconnect 20 years later only to realize they were meant for each other.
We're not meant for each other.
I know. In the story, I would be the evil white American husband standing in the way of destiny.
So I'm thinking about fate some more here, and I'm thinking about the TV miniseries, The Last of Us. It's true that all the characters in it are living in this situation that's totally beyond their control. I mean, how much freedom do they have?
Some, but not much. Like, a lot of them don't have the freedom to not get eaten by cordyceps, which is a freedom that I take for granted every day.
Let's go, come on.
Get in.
Joel!
Denise, you get back inside the house! You lock your doors now! Come on, get in!
They often don't have a lot of freedom from interpersonal violence. Their lives are pretty crappy. But I guess some of them managed to carve out a decent place for themselves through some combination of luck and good choices.
Yeah, I'm thinking in part of the, you know, famous, the justifiably famous third episode, which focuses on a gay couple who've carved out this little tiny space of maybe utopia in the midst of this vast devastation.
Maybe you are decent people. Maybe not. Doesn't matter. We're self-sufficient here. I don't need you or your friend complicating our lives. Is that clear?
They have this option partly because they're super lucky. So Nick Offerman's character, and oh gosh, he's great in this, is a prepper. He got lucky that all of his paranoid beliefs were true. Probably not because of how he formed them.
Hmm. Yeah, they were right for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
Right, things just turned out that way. And it's lucky that Frank, this sweet guy who wouldn't hurt a flea, runs into Bill instead of somebody who really wants to murder him. And, you know, it's lucky that they have chemistry. It's not like they have a great dating pool in the post-apocalypse.
I wonder if we're not supposed to see Bill and Frank as a commentary or maybe even a critique of the main protagonist, or one of the main protagonists of The Last of Us, Joel, the way that he feels like everything is just, he has to do everything. Like everything he chooses doesn't feel like a choice, that he's constrained, that there's only one way out.
I made this decision for your own good. You'll be way better off with Tommy. He knows the area better than I do.
Do you give a shit about me or not?
Of course I do.
Then what are you so afraid of?
Okay, but that brings me to one of the really interesting moral dilemmas in this show. And again, big spoiler coming. The two main characters, Joel and Ellie, have been wandering through these badlands, and Joel has been trying to make sure that Ellie survives. She's a teenager who has an immunity to the cordyceps infection. And the aim is to take her to some medical researchers who are hoping to make a vaccine somehow on the basis of her immunity. And he delivers her to the doctors, but then he learns that if they proceed with their experiments, she will die. So now he has to decide whether to save humanity at the cost of Ellie or save Ellie at the cost of humanity.
How long till she's torn apart by infected or murdered by raiders? Because she lives in a broken world that you could have saved.
Maybe. But it isn't for you to decide.
Or you. So what would she decide? Because I think she'd want to do what's right.
That seems like a genuine choice, a difficult decision, a moral dilemma, and also one where it's not clear that we look kindly on Joel, the main character.
So I actually think the way that the show set this up was a little bit strange in one respect. Normally, you see this kind of thing presented as a trolley problem. There's this kind of classic case. Is it okay to kill one person to save a bunch more people? And this is the situation that the surgeons who are going to kill Ellie are in. They might kill one person to save humanity. And that seems like a real moral dilemma. Joel's decision is different Should he kill a bunch of people to save one person who is special to him and also prevent the salvation of humanity? So I think it's kind of no accident that he doesn't come out looking good here. There's a piece of evidence for this after he saves Ellie, which is that he then lies to Ellie about having killed all of those people and about the fact that those people were going to kill her.
Swear to me that everything you said about the Fireflies is true.
I swear.
And I don't think that's presented as a good or desirable choice sort of by the show. I think we're supposed to feel weird about that.
Speaking of difficult choices, we've got a difficult choice ourselves to make. We've got this great film, Past Lives, and this miniseries, The Last of Us, up for a Dionysus Award.
And I agree it's a difficult choice because, as Ray brilliantly pointed out, Nora has to decide whether she's Na Young or Nora. Mm. And we've got Joel who has to decide whether to save humanity or to save a person who's really dear to him. Mm. Which is the more moving film, Jeremy?
Well, I've been swayed by Ray's arguments, and I think the 2024 Dionysus Award for Most Moving Film or TV Show About Difficult Choices goes to Past Lives.
Good choice. This is the objectively correct move.
Wow, Ray, this has just been a great conversation. I'm thinking really differently about both of these works of art, and thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Ray Briggs, Stanford philosopher and debater of difficulties. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our annual Dionysus Awards show.
Let's get a nomination from the floor. Kasia in Ithaca, New York. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so Kasia, you've got a movie for us. What's the name of that movie?
Yes, it's Anatomy of a Fall.
Oh, I saw that film. Can you give us a 10-second or 20-second synopsis?
It's a courtroom drama in which a woman is suspected of having murdered her husband. Mm.
What is philosophically interesting about this film?
So this movie only pretends to be a courtroom drama. The more interesting thing about it is that the woman is a writer and has written a novel about a woman who murders her husband, which is part of course, the mystery and intrigue. The movie begins with a student coming to interview the woman writer about her work, and there's a whole back and forth and a conversation about whether or not something has to actually happen in reality for a writer to be able to write about it. That they can improvise, they can change things, maybe they can embellish, but does something have to have happened?
What I do know about is my interest in you, and that is real.
Yeah, but still, you had to meet me first. I'm real in front of you now.
Yes, that you are.
Yeah. Yes, so for you to start inventing, you need something real first.
I think that's the question that the whole movie turns around, and indeed the resolution at the end, without giving anything away, is all about a story that is told. And I think the final question at the end of the movie is whether or not that story is a fiction.
I mean, one of the reasons why I think people are caring more and more about kind of the authenticity of experience that leads to fiction is identity politics, that it should be grounded in the author's own cultural background and traditions. Does that matter in this movie, Kasia?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I don't think that's what the movie is really sort of talking about, is like debate, you know, those debates about cultural appropriation or other things.
What about gender, though? I mean, this is a film directed by a woman, and the main character is a woman. Is that, could we think of it that way, that this is a film by women about women, so to speak? And so could the question of authenticity come up at that level?
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't, you know, want to invest too heavily in an argument that like only a woman director could have made this movie. But I think that where you see the kind of question of gender is in the way that it plays on your expectations about a courtroom drama, that it sets you up to think that the important question is whether or not she committed the murder. And I have been asking people who have seen the movie afterwards, you know, do you think that that's actually the question? And almost everyone I've spoken to has said no.
Right.
I'm certain that I know the correct answer.
I think I had a very different experience of this film than the people that you've talked to. I found myself throughout the film uncertain whether or not this character had committed the crime that she was accused of. Yeah. I wasn't quite sure what the stakes of the film were supposed to be, but I was pretty sure that I wasn't sure. So, I was pretty confident that some of the ostensible clues were irrelevant to the court case. So the stuff about people's sexual lives seemed to be completely irrelevant to me. So maybe I'm just a bad viewer of this film.
But the fact that you recognize that it's feeding you clues that are irrelevant, right?
Yeah.
Is significant.
So, Josh, I think this film sounds like a strong candidate for the classically established Dionysus Award category of a philosophically interesting film, which seems to be about one thing but is in fact about another.
I might add a rider to that. I think it's a candidate for the category philosophically interesting film that seems to be about one thing but is really about another and was watched poorly by Josh. Congratulations to Anatomy of a Fall, and thank you very much, Kasia, for the great nomination.
Thank you.
If you've got a thought-provoking movie from the past year that wasn't discussed on today's show, tell us about it. Send an email to comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2024.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Pedro Jimenez, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from subscribers to our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed
or misexpressed
on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and screen our library of nearly 600 episodes. I'm Josh Lander.
And I'm Jeremy Sable. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.